vae, lele le manue.
Join us for our monthly movie event, KBOO at the Clinton. This month, on October 9th, KBOO will host a screening of The U.S. vs. John Lennon, a 2006 documentary film about John Lennon and his transformation from Beatle to anti-war activist and the repression he faced because of his political activities. That's KBOO at the Clinton with The U.S. vs. John Lennon on Thursday, October 9th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm Erin Yankee, today's host of Art Focus. We'll spend the next half hour with Dawn Pyle, a Toronto musician, producer, artist, and author. His book, Trouble in the Camera Club, published in 2011, documents his photographs and experiences of the birth of punk rock in Toronto from 1976 through 1980. His photographs will be at the Portland Museum of Modern Art from September 30th through October 5th.
My name is Dawn Pyle. I'm a musician, producer, recording engineer who does all kinds of other things. Artist is the umbrella term. I've been in bands since I was 16 years old, playing in Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet, Fifth Column, King Cobb Steely, Phonocomb, and I have this book, Trouble in the Camera Club.
So you had been taking photographs throughout the years?
Yeah, there are pictures of me that my mother has where I'm probably 4 years old, standing at the opening of like a canvas tent in this property that she owned in the wilderness, and I've got a camera around my neck. I've got like a towel around my waist and a camera around my neck. So I was taking pictures like from very early on. I think my conscious aesthetic was like of getting pictures of everything. I have to have pictures of all of our hamsters and all of our guinea pigs and my sisters and my mother and my teacher. So it was like very much like portraiture, and a lot of my music photographs are portraits as well. It's something that I really noticed when I worked on them or when I look at them all together, that a lot of them are portraits more than like super action shots. So I took photographs with Instamatic point-and-shoot things until I got in high school and borrowed 35mm camera from school and then saved up and bought my own in 1977. That was coinciding with when punk was just starting to explode. So a lot of my earliest better photographs are, my 35mm photographs are of the beginning of the punk scene, the bands that were sort of attached to that, or just everything I was seeing at the time. So friends of mine, you know, photos of the city. I've been taking pictures, God, for like 48 years. That's ridiculous.
So then you have the story of, like, discovering these photos that make up Trouble in the Camera Club.
Yeah, when I shot the things, I had printed some of the prints. I was processing the black and white and made the mistake of attempting color. My very first color roll that I processed was of the Patti Smith Group, you know, something that is pretty precious to me now, and I wish I hadn't have, but whatever. With the black and white stuff, I would mostly make a contact sheet of what I had, and from that, tiny images, you could see, like, oh, that one looks good, that one looks good, and out of 36 pictures, I might have printed, like, two frames. Consequently, in every 36 roll, I had another 34 pictures that I hadn't really seen since 1978 or so. Over the years, different people have asked me for things, like some of the people who are in the bands who knew that I had photographs of them have asked me, you know, years later, do you have a photograph of Sam for his 50th birthday, you know, that kind of thing. And so I would revisit my negatives from time to time. And so I was always kind of curious about what was there, but I didn't really think that there was anything like great. So I decided to do a photo show because I thought, like, oh, I probably got like 10 good photos, and this friend of mine had bought this great bar and perfect environment. So I sent my negatives to a friend in Vancouver who had a scanner, and he started scanning them. When I got the first batch of contact strips back, I was pretty surprised. I was quite excited at the pictures I saw because there was a lot of really nice-looking photographs. Also of bands that, particularly the Toronto bands, there's not a lot of photographs of these particular artists. So I started scanning them myself. And so I started off thinking I had like 10 pictures. And I ended up showing about 50 at that first photo exhibit. That resulted in me being offered a book deal, which is now my book, Trouble in the Camera Club.
What's your favorite photo?
It changes all the time. Right now, my favorite photograph is one that I have of Deborah Harry, where she's kind of like falling backwards and her eyes are like wide open. She's kind of corpse-looking. It's exciting to see something new in things that you're so familiar with. And there's like particular things about different photographs that catch my attention. There's a photograph of Vera, who's sang in the group Tyranna, that ended up being on the front cover of an album of theirs. They were from 1978, but an album came out in Italy only in like 2011. That photo and some of the other photos of her band Tyranna, those are some of my favorites right now because they're taken on the street that I grew up in. So I can see my public school in the background, and I know that right around that corner my best friend lived, and everything, my childhood, my mother, where I grew up, punk rock, my school, you know, it's got a lot of subtext in it that other people don't see.
Right, the layers of history. You talk about the power of photography and how photos were an easy way to become what you wanted to be.
Yeah, and it was Tyranna that I was specifically talking about in the quote that you just mentioned. Those photographs of them, those were taken like maybe even on the first day that those three people met each other. So Vera had put an ad out looking for, you know, musicians because she wanted to start a band. She met this guitar player, who's this guy John Ziegler. So then she could put another ad out saying, you know, singer and guitar player looking for a bass player, drummer. The third guy in the picture is the bass player. So they didn't even have a drummer at that point. It's kind of like, I've written it out, I have a picture of it, so therefore we are a band. I've created the documentation to show that they are a band and they're posing in ways that look like a band. Therefore, they are a band. You know, for a lot of young people, too, as I mean, you see it now. It's super intense with cell phone photographs where people are constantly refining and, like, so self-conscious. I mean, there's much more hyper-consciousness about your looks, your appearance, and your image now than there was at that time. And that's something that I think just like keeps accelerating and accelerating. But, you know, photographs are a way for you to step outside of yourself and look at yourself. It's quite fascinating how much that frozen moment in time is about presenting something that might not be true or real on either moment, either side of that particular picture.
Is that why you shy away from talking about this as a historical document?
Well, not really. When I started working on the book, it was a photographic book, and I knew that I wanted to do writing to give it a context and write some things about it. But when I started writing, I mean, it took me a while to find the tone of what it was that I wanted to write about, and I didn't really intend for it to be more about me, but the only way I think that these photographs kind of made sense is putting them in the context of what my experience was, like how these photographs came to be. So much of what I perceived of was completely about being a teenager and what was going on in my life and what was happening at high school and my place in discovering new worlds outside of what my life had been up until that point. But when I started working on it, I started to tell the story about some of these bands, and I very, very quickly realized that that is a completely different book, and I could not write two books. So doing a sort of like a history book where I actually gave the band's histories, that would have required so much research. They do have a kind of like quote-unquote historical document quality to them because they are showing something from the past and places that don't exist, people that are no longer alive. But I didn't want it to be in the sense of it being like an authoritative history. It could only be what my experience was, not what the truth is, which is totally elusive anyway, because the book that is supposed to be the oral history of Toronto, 90% of that book I, you know, had first-hand experience with. So it was interesting to read that from other people's point of view, because their perception of certain things that were happening were quite different from mine. History is always super slippery, and especially like that book being written by someone who was young. The author was only like 25 years old, so not even alive when this happened. It automatically creates a remove that there's now like two layers of kind of interpretation.
Yeah, and then what kind of mood they were in on the day they got interviewed, and if they were romantic or cynical or...
Absolutely, and you know, there's such different points of view about what that time was. I mean, there's so many people that are stuck on that time as being like the greatest thing ever, and it being like, you know, that they invented something. You know, every generation invents its own thing, and all of those things are much more important to you. They have much more meaning for you when you are 15 years old and you're having the experience for the first time. No adult can tell you that your experience is an old experience, that they've already had your experience. It's just not possible. Nothing has ever been as good as these days' point of view is something that I don't share at all. And there are a lot of people who are quoted in that book who believe that, because for them, that was the best time of their life. For me, it was amazing. But it was not, you know, I don't live my life stuck in that moment.
My name is Erin Yankee. This is Art Focus. And we are in the middle of a conversation with Dawn Pyle, photographer, musician, and artist from Toronto, Canada. You being a photographer before you were a musician, you getting to use the camera, it seemed like to also get into these clubs and the gay bars that you wouldn't have been able to get in without a camera. So do you kind of want to talk about the access that it gave you?
Well, I don't know if the camera specifically like gave me access, but in a way it was kind of like... you know, when you see a kid and they cover their face and they think that they can't be seen because they've covered their face or they've covered their eyes, I think my camera was sort of like that, that if I have this thing that I can be sort of behind, I won't be seen. You know, also when you're 15 years old and you're trying to get into a club, you know, at that time the drinking age had gone from like 21 to 18 here briefly. So when I started going, you had to be 21 to get into some of these clubs and then turned to 18. And then they kind of settled on 19 and it's remained at 19 for a long time. So when you go into these places for the first time, you've had years and years of being told that you are not allowed here. And, you know, you see all these beautiful old bars in downtown Toronto that you get a glimpse inside as you walk by, if someone's going in. And so, you know, there's all these like hidden worlds that you have no access to. So the first time that you're able to go into those things, you know, it's hard not to be self-conscious. You feel very conspicuous because this is not a place that you've ever been to, but also that you're really not supposed to be there. You have no idea about how people are going to be about enforcing those rules. Very fortunately at that time, things seemed to be a lot looser in some ways. You know, there was sort of like the institutional bars, which would be like the bars that were on the main street and controlled by the Musicians Union, which at that time controlled almost everything. You know, it was really only around 1977 that people started having one-off things, shows in halls. The art college started doing things in their auditorium. There were these spaces that were not as regulated. It wasn't such an issue for the people who were at the door taking it $2 or your $3. And quite often it would be someone, a friend of the band, working the door. So it's in their best interest to have more people come in. So I was let into a lot of places and quickly I was a regular. So I got into things and I was tall, big for my age. So I even though I felt very conspicuous, I wasn't questioned. But getting into these spaces felt very covert, and it really felt like going undercover in the world of adults. And until I was comfortable, I mostly wanted to be unseen, to the point where, like, I stopped wanting to go to the shows with some of my friends from high school because they all looked younger than me, and they were not quite as adventurous as I was. So I started going out on my own. And then, you know, of course, after not very long, you start making friends within the new scene, and you just find your place. And then, if you know, I started being in bands too, and so that automatically makes you okay to be in those spaces, because, you know, well, he's in a band, so therefore he must be old enough.
When you talk about the end of when you stopped taking your camera to every single show, is that because you were playing in bands, or
really, when I was taking photographs, it was my way of participating in the thing. So, you know, I really wanted to have pictures of all these bands and was really passionate about them and would go see them as much as I could. But when I started being in my own band, carrying a camera is painful. A lot of the shows were pretty rough. And as the audience grew and grew, things got kind of rougher. You know, it was like harder and harder to protect your camera. And once I started exploring gay scene as well, like quite often I would go to a show and then go to a gay bar after. So lugging a camera around with me everywhere was just a burden, especially since I was just like carrying it around in a plastic bag.
Do you think that your exploring the punk scene helped you also like find the gay scene in Toronto at the time?
Yeah, you know, pretty much. It was kind of a bad situation at home, so if my mother accepted that the kids were out a lot, I was downtown a lot and knew the downtown quite well, and I was also really obsessed with records, so I would go downtown every week and do the rounds of all the record stores. From like 9 years old, I knew downtown quite well. And as far as like being gay, it was something that I knew from as early as I can remember. Even if I didn't put words to it, I knew that I was attracted to men. So that was something that I was looking for and had one eye out for, and an awareness of all these things from a very young age. You know, lots of kids, I think, are not given as much credit as they should for how much they really know. I remember my mother talking to someone else in the family about my sister-in-law's brother getting in trouble doing bad things at the park with men. And I was probably like, you know, 7 years old, but I instinctively knew that, oh, what is that? What are they talking about? There's something that I want to know about. And also, a lot of the music that I was listening to, like David Bowie particularly, David Bowie and Lou Reed, you know, they sing about sexual situations, and there was a lot of suggestive lyrics about secrecy and about hidden sexuality that was really captivating to me, really sparked my imagination, and really like made me interested and want to know more, seeking out things that I instinctively knew that this is gay, or there's something about this sexuality that's talked about here that has a veil of secrecy or shame on it. I'm curious about it because I have my own veil of secrecy and shame around my own sexuality and being in the closet and not feeling that that was safe up until a certain age, until you come out or until you're fully comfortable being out. There's so much innuendo, there's so much secrecy. So, you know, when you would see things that were totally, like, celebratory or that were overt, they were completely exciting. Things like After Dark magazine of Grace Jones at Studio 54 in, you know, 1973. It's like, oh, my God, like, that looks really exciting. She's presenting herself as this super sexual creature, so it's, like, very intriguing and exciting. And same with David Bowie, the whole Ziggy Stardust persona, and then particularly the Diamond Dogs album, which came out in 74, so I was like 12 years old when that record came out. that record had a huge impact on me, and there are a number of lyrics on that record that are about secret meetings and pretending to meet someone for some other reason than what you're really meeting them. It was all stuff that was, you know, going on in my own life. So I really, really related to those things. And there was like a real darkness. And, you know, I was always attracted to darker and heavier music and art. There was a lot of intrigue and mystery there. And, you know, with that comes a lot of excitement. When I was doing this, it was really the same period that people like Robert Mapplethorpe were doing super sexual and gay photographs. So, like, you know, all that stuff was really the most out there days of the sexual revolution, particularly in gay terms. You know, it was before AIDS, before, you know, HIV, you know, really radically changed so many things about gay culture, where it really altered the sexual revolution and made things much more overt, where, you know, up until that point, like, you know, a leather bar would be in hidden places. When you went into the place, those things were not hidden. Those things were, like, on display super prominently. People would be having sex. I mean, things were actually way more extreme than they are now. The downtowns of everywhere in North America have been homogenized in quite a large way, largely because of the explosion in real estate values and regulation and conservatism. You know, regulation has increased and increased so that so many things about having fun in all aspects of culture are regulated in such an intense way, like fences. You know, there has to be a fence up there in case someone falls in or gets hurt. So much babysitting in every aspect of our lives now that is largely about the government having control of us, you know, is the bottom line for me. Not long after that, in the 80s, you know, when the AIDS crisis hit, that's when gays, for example, were not hidden, really became super visible and led to where we are now, which is so radically different from 10 years ago and 20 years ago. I feel very fortunate that I experienced a lot of things before and after, you know, the sexual revolution and the advent of AIDS. You know, for me, like living here, the, you know, the music scenes and the punk scene and the gay scene, they didn't cross over very much. There was very, very minimal crossover, even though, like, a lot of the people that I knew who were the downtown punks and outsiders, there were a couple of gay bars that we went to, but that was mostly because a lot of the women that I knew were going there because it was a safe place for them. They could go and just, you know, hang out before going out somewhere else where they weren't going to get harassed, where they would have fun, and they enjoyed the music. And there were a couple of gay clubs that had punk bands, but the line was very distinct. It was like, okay, the punk thing is starting now, all the gays would leave. Or this time is the gay time, and so no punks would go in there at that time. So there was a real distinct line. And when I started going to gay bars and having gay friends, there were none that were interested in the music that I was interested in. So it was a real divide. Those things were so at odds with each other. And then, like, the first gay friends that I knew, so many of them died. My first boyfriend died. Almost all the first people that I was friends with when I started going to gay clubs are dead now. Some of them, one of them was murdered. You know, a number of them have died from, you know, HIV, AIDS-related illnesses. And kind of the same thing in the punk thing. Like, you know, as things progressed and got into, like, you know, 1979, 1980, so many people were moving into heroin. People started dying of drug overdoses, suicide. So, like, there was a lot of death and real heaviness. But they were totally in, like, separate channels. They were in two parts of my life that didn't cross over until, like, years later. Those two things never really met for me until years later.
People don't really think about that anymore, except for the code of, like, oh, disco sucks. And you're like, oh, well, you're probably talking about gay dance nights.
You know, the disco sucks thing, I mentioned that in my book, saying that disco wasn't the end of, you know, to me and some of my friends, it was the Doobie Brothers and the Steve Miller Band. who represented the mainstream of heterosexism. So many of my friends in the early punk scene were women, and they were not afraid to get down. They were who I would be with at some of these gay clubs, and that's where you would hear a lot of dance music. And, you know, not even just them, other guys. I was in, like, the drummer in Crash Kills 5 was totally into disco, and remember him, you know, playing ABBA and Boney M and Donna Summer. She was, like, so popular in the circles that I was hanging out in. And these were punks, you know, not, like, gay scenes. So the whole, like, disco sucks thing, definitely there. But I feel like that was a real conservative element of punk. You know, as I'm preparing my slideshows for doing these talks out west, I've been looking at, like, you know, a lot of the Vancouver bands and the DOA record, you know, Disco Sucks. And I remember when that record came out and thinking, that's not the way I feel. I think a lot of the anti-disco thing was homophobia. Really, the roots of so much gay stuff, I mean, you know, it's you hear it over and over and over now about what an influence David Bowie had. And I think that there's two major camps within the beginnings of punk. The ones that came from the British approach, which was of sophistication and, you know, glam and wittier or artier, which is, you know, Roxy Music, David Bowie. And then more of an American approach, which is like, you know, the MC5 and Stooges, which is more about being brutish and being thuggish. Particularly the MC5, like celebrating dumbness, you know. The Ramones even, like the Ramones comically celebrating dumbness. It was kind of interesting that those two sides, how each of them kind of like had a major theme to them. And there's all kinds of anomalies within that. I'm talking like in super generalizations, but it was kind of like the MC5 people versus the David Bowie people.
Don Pyle will be showing his photos from Trouble in the Camera Club at the Portland Museum of Modern Art at 5202 North Albina Avenue. The Portland Museum of Modern Art is inside Mississippi Records. The opening will be Friday, October 3rd at 7 o'clock, and Don will present the Out of Focus Talking Slideshow. And what are you going to talk about?
Well, a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about. I'll show different photographs. Some of them are in the book, and a lot of them aren't. I have pretty bad eyesight, so I have a lot of photographs that would have been amazing photographs if they were in focus. So, you know, I show some of those and talk about them. And, you know, talk about details that are in the picture, and also culturally some of the things that I was feeling or thinking or seeing that were going on at the time. Sometimes it is, like, about the moment before or after the photograph was taken, or of things that happened to particular people or who they became or how, in retrospect, I can see particular things fit together. A lot of it is stuff that I was thinking about as I put these photographs together. It's all kinds of observations about the photographs. I feel like in so many ways I see what my experience about the whole punk scene was to be misrepresented. So have a take which I guess is, I don't know if it's in the minority or maybe it's not, because so many people who've looked at my book have contacted me and said, like, this was my experience. So it's been, doing the book was a really interesting way to meet and talk with and connect with so many other people all over North America who had very similar experiences to me, not just like being gay, but what they were observing.
We have been speaking with Don Pyle, musician, producer, artist, and author of Trouble in the Camera Club. Thanks, Don, for talking to us, and thanks also to Scott Moore for all of the arranging help. My name is Erin Yankee. This has been Art Focus. If you'd like to hear this interview again, you can find it at kboo.fm. Thanks for listening.
Tune into KBOO on Wednesday, October 1st for Turning the Tide on Climate Change.
An all-day special about climate change and the actions we must take now.
And don't miss a special guest, Naomi Klein, talking about her new book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate at 1 p.m.
That's Turning the Tide on Climate Change on Wednesday, October 1st. 8 a.m., 4 p.m. on
KBOO Portland.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the final La Peña Flamenca de Portland of the season. On September 26th, at the steep and thorny way to heaven, La Peña Flamenca de Portland presents Berto Boyd with Daniel Azcarate and Elena Villa. There will be two performances, one beginning at 7 p.m. and the other at 9:30 p.m. La Peña Flamenca is a not-for-profit cultural association that promotes flamenco performances in Portland. Again, that's La Peña Flamenca de Portland, Friday, September 26th at the steep and thorny way to heaven on Southeast 2nd Avenue between Madison and Hawthorne in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Ghosts of Tonkin on Saturday, September 27th at 7:30 p.m. This award-winning play dramatizes the behind-the-scenes story of how public officials brought about one of the most devastating chapters in the history of the United States, the Vietnam War, and of Oregon Senator Wayne Morse, one of only two congressmen to vote against the Tonkin Resolution. There will be a discussion following the play, moderated by KBOO's Joanne Hardesty, and includes playwright Steve Lyons and others. Again, that's The Ghosts of Tonkin, Saturday, September 27th at Lincoln Hall on the Portland State University campus, 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on The Ghosts of Tonkin can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.